Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
One of my favorite objects in the exhibition is a biconical bead. It's an object that I've known of for a long time. It's in the collection of the Troyes Institute of Art. It dates to the late 18th or 19th century, and it was probably made in Senegal. It's quite large. It's 2 to 3 inches in diameter at its widest point. A biconical bead basically looks like two ice cream cones that are put together at the mouth. And so this is a bead that I first saw illustrated in a book in the 1990s. And I've just always loved it. And it was only through this project that I've come to understand where that bead shape comes from. It's actually a bead shape that originates in the medieval period and possibly even before. And it's really widespread across the Islamic world.
And that is the voice of Kathleen Bickford Burzok, and she's describing her favorite object from the collection she curated for Northwestern's Block Museum of Art, titled Caravans of Gold, Fragments in Time. After it closed at Northwestern in July of 2019, it traveled to the Aga Khan Museum in Toronto, where it is running until February 2020. And then starting April 8th, it'll be at the National Museum of African Art at the Smithsonian Institute, where it will be until November 29th, 2020. The exhibit is a history of medieval Africa, drawing off of discourses of globality, migration, language, and religion. Now, released alongside it, and the reason we're talking to Kathleen today, is the exhibit's catalog, which was produced by both Princeton University Press and the Block Museum 2019. It's not your conventional catalog. Yes, it includes details of the items in the collection. They're all photographed stunningly. But the format is totally readable. It's a selection of essays. Some are archaeological, some are written from the perspective of art history, some are more creative. If you physically cannot make it to the exhibit, the catalog is a totally different experience, and I highly encourage you to pick it up and enjoy it. Even if you can make it to the exhibit, the catalog will enrich and deepen your knowledge of these worlds. We should also note that the catalog was shortlisted for the Alice Award, which is awarded annually to an illustrated book of distinction. So that's the level of quality. So today on New Books, we'll be talking to Kathleen Bickford Burzok, who is Associate Director of Curatorial Affairs at the Block Museum of Art at Northwestern University. She is the author of For Hearth and Altar, African Ceramics from the Keith Acipol Collection, and the co-editor of Representing Africa in American Art Museums, A Century of Collecting and Display. And she edited Caravans of Gold, the catalog. I'm going to let her introduce herself to us now.
I came to art history as an undergraduate. I had the good fortune, I was at a very small university in Colorado. It's called the University of Northern Colorado. I was an art major, And I had the good fortune of having a wonderful mentor who was the art historian in the department. His name is Chip Cornell. And he was an Africanist by training. So he taught classes on African art within the curriculum, the art history curriculum there. And he encouraged me to become an art historian. I then went to graduate school at Indiana University, and my advisors there were Roy Sieber and Patrick McNaughton. Patrick worked in Mali and was an inspiration for my deep interest in the history of Mali. Roy Sieber was an art historian who also was deeply involved in museums and the work of exhibition making, and was one of the founders of the National Museum of African Art, was their first chief curator. So Roy got me excited about working in museums. And, you know, the rest is sort of history, I guess. I took those seeds from those wonderful mentors and built it into the career that I have today. I was for 18 years the curator of African art at the Art Institute of Chicago. And then 6 years ago, I moved from there to the Block Museum here at Northwestern University to be the Associate Director of Curatorial Affairs, essentially the chief curator, because Northwestern wanted a museum that engaged with art across time, place, and culture. Northwestern is also the first American, the first U.S. university to start an African studies program. It was started by Melville J. Herskovitz. And so the university has a deep commitment to Africa and African studies. And so as an Africanist, I couldn't think of a more exciting place to work at a museum. And we have the wonderful Herskovitz Library here, which is one of the most important libraries of African studies in the world. And in fact, some of the manuscript pages in the Caravans of Gold exhibition are on loan from the collections of the Herskovitz Library, as is the beautiful mid-16th century copy of Leo Africanus's Description of Africa.
Yeah, I noticed both of those when I went in. As an intellectual historian, I couldn't help but look to see where the provenance of the manuscripts were, and I was really excited to see that they came from the collection.
Well, we're really privileged also to have three books on loan from the Ahmed Baba Library in Timbuktu. And it's worth saying that just like the book has contributions from scholars working across working in Mali, Morocco, and Nigeria, we also have loans from Mali, Morocco, and Nigeria, and we're so grateful to the institutions in those countries that have lent materials and works of art to this exhibition for a 2-year period.
Caravans of Gold, the catalog edition, is a sight to behold. It's rather large, it's typical of a coffee table style book, and it covers different genres of writing, and the text is divided into four sections. The first section is titled Groundwork, and it looks at medieval trade routes, cultural heritage, gold. The second section, which is titled Sites, questions geography at the city level, at the regional level, and it looks at it through both a political and an economic perspective. The third section, titled Matter in Motion, naturally looks at how objects move. And the final section, Reverberation, closes with a piece on contemporary migration today, which includes a discussion of refugees.
Paint a picture for us of the Trans-Saharan region during the period the exhibit covers, the 8th through the 16th centuries, and what civilizations this exhibit covers.
Mm-hmm. So the exhibition and the book both look at a really broad scope of territory. This is a story that where many different regions connect. It's trade that was functioning locally, regionally, interregionally, and at very, very long distances. So the Sahara is its heart. In the 8th to the 16th century, The Sahara and its close sort of fringes were predominantly the place of Amazigh or Berber peoples. And in the exhibition, we particularly have a focus on the Tuareg, because they were really primary in being the masters of movement across the Sahara in that period. And but then the exhibition also intersects, and the book, with the Atlas region of Morocco, and then North Africa, including cities along and around the Mediterranean, and then Europe itself, and then moving southward, there's a big focus in the exhibition on the Western Sudan and that sort of Mandé region of the Western Sudan, and then the forest regions of West Africa. So we look at how the Sahara is a conduit for trade, but so is the Niger River, and so is the Mediterranean. And it's a story that has to be that, where we see how regions and languages and cultural practices and religious practices all sort of meet up and require navigation and negotiation to make this kind of trade happen.
Today, we take for granted that the objects that we hold in front of us can come from a multitude of places, from different countries, from different continents. But what if I told you that in medieval West Africa, you could find porcelain from China?
So you mentioned the movement of Arabic, the movement of ideas. What about the movement of commodities, so goods and also enslaved peoples? How does that factor into the exhibition and the catalog?
The movement of things is the kind of core of especially the first part of the exhibition. Actually, it moves through the whole entire exhibition, because that is what comes to us in the archaeological record. And so another one of the contributors of the catalog, Abdallah Fili, who's a Moroccan archaeologist, has called the project an homage to archaeology. And in some ways, it's very beautiful, but it's also really true. So in the archaeological record, we find fragments of things that were part of that past. And they evoke for us the important commodities that were circulating, things like glass beads and terracotta and glazed ceramics and vessel glass and copper and its alloys and gold. So this is what the sort of starting point is for the exhibition. But we can't imagine the movement of all those materials without also thinking about and seeing the movement of people, and then the movement of languages, the movement of religious practices, the movement of ideas. And of course, slavery is perhaps one of the hardest things to make tangible through an art exhibition, because while it's written into the texts of the time, there aren't a lot of material, or actually I don't know of any material remains of the medieval period that make it tangible in terms of trans-Saharan trade. So we reference it in the exhibition by referring to the descriptions in Arabic of trans-Saharan trade that are contemporaneous with the medieval period. So writers like El-Bakri and Al-Umari and Ibn Battuta and others. And then we also look briefly at the Ganawa cultural practices in Morocco, and how people who identify as Ganawa in Morocco are identifying as the descendants of enslaved West Africans.
Caravans of Gold, both as an exhibit and as a catalog. And I think you're starting to see that we're both talking about the exhibit and the catalog because they're so much intertwined, even though both can be consumed as different objects. So the exhibit and the catalog are both trying to disrupt your notions of what is medieval, what is global, what is Arabic, what is African, what is Muslim. But what about something more basic? What about what we consider cities?
Okay, so if we can take a, we can move over from things that do move to things that don't move, cities and settlements, because that's quite a big part of the exhibition. I mean, I really like what you said about putting one of your authors, how the exhibition is an homage to archaeology, because when you pick up the catalog, it's this gorgeous, heavy coffee table book, and it really does, I think, honor the objects in the exhibition. When I saw the exhibition, all the objects looked familiar, and it was partially because they were photographed so beautifully and so well that you could appreciate them in person just as well as you could appreciate them on the page. So it is really an achievement itself. But the articles in it, I was surprised to see, I mean, easily the first half, the first 75% is archaeology that's really woven in well with the history of the period. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I was getting a history lesson, but I was also getting quite a lot of information about the history of contemporary archaeology as well, which was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And to see sort of the discovery and the rediscovery of all these places that in your mind are almost imaginary, all these legends associated
right.
with like Sijil Masa. So can you speak to sort of the role of cities and urban settlements in trans-Saharan trade in the period that the exhibition covers?
Sure. So, the exhibition focuses on three major archaeological sites in the Saharan region, and then three additional sites in the forest region and in the central Sudan. So the three Saharan sites are Sijil Masa in present-day Morocco and Tadmeka and Gao in present-day Mali. We selected those sites because they represent three different zones that were part of this trade, the northern fringe of the Sahara Desert, the southern fringe of the Sahara Desert, and the western Sudan and the arc of the Niger River. Also, they were within the countries that we that I was working with as our partners for requesting loans of materials to be in the exhibition. So the exhibition has loans from Mali, Morocco, and Nigeria. There are other sites that could have been in this exhibition in Mauritania, in Senegal, in Niger, in Ghana, and Burkina Faso, but exhibitions have to be pragmatic at a certain level, right? You have to do what you can achieve. And so partnering with three African countries was the capacity that we had for and still sort of to still achieve the project. So it's interesting, and I think not widely known, that urbanism existed in the Western Sudan from at least the 4th century and even possibly before. The same is true in the Central Sudan. And there are sites in the forest region of West Africa that date to the 8th century, and they're well-developed, and that makes you think that surely there was urbanism in the forest region also well before the 8th century. So as in the 8th century, as trans-Saharan trade begins to amp up, that's not happening within a vacuum. That's building on already well-established trade networks. And there's even movement across the Sahara that predates the 8th century. So the exhibition moves both through place and through time. And so in the book, I thought it would be interesting to really do these sort of deep considerations of these sites to kind of root the project into those places that are the key case studies in the exhibition.
One of the most fascinating objects in the exhibit, or some of the most fascinating objects in the exhibit, are those which come from, those which come from the Saharan region, but sort of also came from other places. So in particular, the uses of ivory in Europe, I thought, were mm-hmm. a genius touch, just to sort of emphasize that this was a place that deserves prominence in sort of the historical narrative that we give to children, the general public.
Mm-hmm.
What inspired that particular move in, like, using these objects such as the Virgin Mary and Son cast in ivory?
Right. So the exhibition and the book let me just take a step back and say that I've been thinking, as I've been working on this project, I've been thinking a lot about the nature of globalism. Mm-hmm. And I've come to understand, you know, there's this global turn in the academic world. And in working through this project, I've come to understand that global turn really is more of a decentralizing turn. So globalism in this exhibition, and for me, is about looking at the world from many different perspectives. And as you shift perspective, you see things differently, and you don't get a complete picture, a full, well-rounded picture, unless you make those localizing moves. And so that is reflected in both in the book and in the exhibition itself. So what we've done in the exhibition, in a sense, is to place the Sahara and its close hinterlands at the center, and we've sort of pushed Europe to the margins. And we've asked the question, which seems so obvious, where did that come from? So we start with that "where did that come from" question with gold, and we open the exhibition with a lot of different examples of gold work from outside of the Western Sudan, but it's all gold that we have good reason to believe originated from sources within the Western Sudan. So when you look at gold fittings that were found in Spain that date to the 12th century, or you look at the gold leaf calligraphy on a page of the Blue Quran, or you look at gold that is on the back of a Sienese panel painting from the 14th century or the 13th century, we're asking, where did that gold come from? And the answer is, it came across the Sahara Desert through trade. And then when we get to a later part of the exhibition and we're looking at the long reaches of Saharan trade, we return to this idea with ivory. And again, we ask that question, where did the ivory that is so it's so iconic in our thinking about medieval Christian material, the medieval Christian material world, Gothic ivories are iconic things. And the answer to that question is that ivory was coming across the Sahara Desert through trade. And we know that specifically for ivory, and this is the brilliant work of one of the contributors to the catalog, Sarah Garin, who has been thinking about the materiality of ivory and has brought into her art historical analysis of it the understanding that it is only the savanna elephant, so an elephant coming from the savanna regions of West Africa, only the savanna elephant can grow its tusks to be wider than 11.5 centimeters above the nerve cavity. So in the Gothic period in Europe, there is a renaissance or kind of a resurgence of ivory carving at a scale that hadn't ever been seen before, or not for a very, very long time. And whenever you find an ivory object from the Gothic period in France, and it has a you can tell that the ivory had a diameter of wider than 11.5 centimeters, you definitively know that that ivory came across the Sahara Desert in trade from West Africa. So that's kind of what we're, the point we're making there.
One of the things I enjoyed the most about the catalog, as I mentioned, you know, I was surprised by by the presence of archaeology and to what extent archaeology was emphasized, partially because it made me think about how objects are found, in addition to the fact that, you know, the provenance of objects, as we're always hearing, when an object is sold or whether or not something was a product of colonial trade or was looted. One thing I really appreciated was that you opened the catalog with this essay about fragments, which references the fact that the title of the exhibition is Caravans of Gold, Fragments in Time. And that's something you see in the exhibit itself, this reference to fragments. I was wondering if you could speak to the question of fragments and also how we piece together histories using different sources.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about Chris Avani's
Yes.
chapter? Yeah, it is so beautiful. So again, in these meetings we had in developing the project, this question of the fragment was something we talked a lot about, because one of the reasons why a show like this has never been done before is because the material past of Africa's medieval period is so highly fragmented. And it's hard to think about how to make space for that in the art museum. So we kind of embraced that challenge because we felt like the story was such an important one to present within the context of the art museum. So starting with this idea of these highly fragmented objects, we began to think about, well, how might we make sense of those fragments? And we came up with a methodology that included juxtaposing fragments with things that help us understand what the fragments were, reading the fragments by looking at these contemporaneous texts, and by putting the texts together with the fragments and the archaeological investigation, we can start to see where grains of truth lie in these sometimes second and third hand descriptions of West Africa from the medieval period. And then by also looking at the fragments through the lens of what happens in more recent times, where we have more material has survived, say from the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, as well as how cultural practices have a legacy or a reflection of the legacies of the past. So the fragment became this sort of poetic idea within the exhibition. And archaeologists sometimes talk about the imaginative quality of their work, and even they have coined this term, the archaeological imagination. And the archaeological imagination is how the fragment from the past can invoke our ability to see and imagine a much bigger context from just a single small thing. And it felt like, because of the nature of the starting point for the exhibition, which are these fragmented excavated materials from these sites around the Sahara Desert, that the fragment had to have an important place in the sort of thematics of the exhibition. I've actually built the exhibition. I see every element of the exhibition in a sense as a fragment at this point. There are fragments of text. There are fragments of the sites themselves are like fragments. When you put multiple sites together, you get a bigger whole, right? We've woven in interviews with archaeologists and art historians, and even with a man who sells salt from the Sahara Desert in the market in Rissani in Morocco. So those interviews are fragments, and the works of art are fragments. And it's only by seeing all those slices of the story side by side that we see this much bigger picture.
No, I really enjoyed, in particular, actually, the fact that you couch the period, the 8th through the 16th centuries, with objects from that predate that and objects that come from the 19th or the 18th century, because I think it's exactly what you said, that there are these continuities that do exist. As much as we think of history as a rupture, as a foreign land, the past as a foreign land, I think you really get the sense that the present can tell us a lot about the past. In particular, I actually saw that represented in the prayer beads
mm-hmm.
from the 18th century, I believe, because that's a practice that continues today.
19th or 20th century, yeah, those are beautiful.
But they also look very different from things I've seen made by North and West African artisans.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking the whole time I was looking at it, I was like, well, how is this different? How is this the same? What does that have to do with trade? What does that have to do with colonialism? What does that have to do with the nature of religious practice? It's this really convoluted question, and it touches on all these different subjects that you, these themes that, rather than subjects, that you interweave into the exhibition itself.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to say one more thing about the fragment that you just reminded me of, because there is that idea of the past, right, is a rupture. But what the beautiful thing about the fragment is that it makes the past present. So in the exhibition, I felt so strongly about having the actual fragments in the exhibition because they're the time travelers. They exist in the present, but they're of the past. And by being in their presence, by looking closely at them, it's almost as if we can connect to the past through them. So because this is an art exhibition, we privilege the importance of actually being in the presence of the thing. And the book is a companion to that experience. So the book does its own work that's different than the exhibition, but the exhibition is very much about being in the presence of the thing.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
There is a social consciousness to its exhibition and to its companion book. History museums, academia, they are not neutral. So now Kathleen is going to comment on the catalog's entry on migration, which mentions, of course, refugees and forced migration.
You had asked that question about Chris Abani's chapter about fragments, but another, I think, important chapter in the book is the last chapter of the book, which is the chapter about migration today. So I've said before that this is an exhibition and a book that the main takeaway, if there could be any single one takeaway, I hope it's that by understanding this the medieval past differently, we can also see the present differently. And the last chapter of the book is an important part of that. It talks about migrations across the Sahara today. It's written by Galia Benaria, who is a faculty member here at Northwestern and founded an institute on forced migration. And she's looking at those movements across the Sahara and across the Mediterranean also through this lens of the past and seeing what the different motivations for people traveling across the Sahara today are, how they are often moving across routes that are the same routes that were traveled in the medieval period, how this travel has been part of life in those regions for a millennia. And
You know, so often migrations of Africans across the Sahara and across the Mediterranean in today's highly politicized world are seen as new or as about, you know, the kind of keeping people in or keeping people out of certain privileged spaces. And I think this look that we take, that Galia Benaria takes of it through this lens of history, is an important corrective to seeing contemporary migrations today.
It's also a good reminder, I think, of the exhibition as a whole, how arbitrary borders are and how recent the invention of borders, and as you mentioned, privileged spaces, so citizenship, for example, right, can be for various individuals. I mean, the motivations for people traveling are different than the same in many
places. So, right, yeah. Right. And one of the things Scalia points out is that in many cases, people are wanting to travel for short periods of time, right? They're wanting to go and come back. I think that's often left out of the way that the story is told.
My frustration with my education and my training as a historian is not new to my listeners. So Kathleen and I are talking about the role of religion and Islam in West Africa across the Sahara, because that's a story that needs to be told. And often, even in the hallowed halls of academia, it's not told.
You mentioned religion, and in particular, this exhibition comes at a really timely moment. We've seen in the last 5 or 6 years the publication of academic monographs, mostly from intellectual history, trying to recenter West Africa in Islamic studies. And it's a push that requires a rethinking in how Islamic studies specialists are trained, because all of a sudden we need different languages. We need to be trained. We need to begin to think about these different histories that we weren't necessarily taught. When I was taught my Islamic civilization introduction class in graduate school, there wasn't a West Africa section. There wasn't an East Africa section. And I asked my advisor, and I was like, well, there aren't enough weeks. We have to cover, you know, the Abbasids and the Mayids. And I was like, and that was the year Osman Kane's book came out. It's like, but this is really important. Yeah. This is clearly, that book sort of served as this roadmap to what needs to be done in the field, what interventions need to be taken, how we need to be trained. And now at the University of Hamburg, you have the Ajami Lab, which is trying to get, training specialists in different scripts, different languages, so that they can access these manuscripts. That is to say, I wanted to ask specifically about the role of religion, and how religion also travels or does not travel. Sometimes things don't necessarily implant when they travel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Here at Northwestern, we also have the Institute for the Study of Islamic Thought in Africa. It's an amazing program and involves, you probably know about it, but the study of the intellectual tradition in the Arabic language as it originates and grows within Islamic, you know, the Islamic world in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. So there was a time, in a much earlier manifestation of this idea, where I, in the 90s, I had an idea of to do an exhibition about Islam in Africa. And for various reasons, that exhibition didn't have legs. But I never left the idea totally behind. And when I started working on this project, it was in an effort to revisit that idea. What I like about what I ended up doing with this project is that it's an exhibition about that's really grounded in history. It's an exhibition about movement and circulation of things, people, and ideas. But Islam is an important facet of that story. So it's not an exhibition about Islam in Africa, but it's an exhibition where Islam and Arabic are important parts of the story. And so I think that through that approach, one can really see how and where Islam and Arabic fit and how essential they are to history. You know, it's impossible to kind of break apart the movement of trade, the movement of Islam, and the movement of Arabic. They go together. And we can see also, because this is about circulation, how West Africans are contributing to that, so that it's not just a kind of one way or even a kind of two way movement. It's really being part of a complex development of identity and religious practices over time.
I hope the message we're getting across is that the exhibition and its catalog or its companion book are telling the same story but in different ways. So if you can't make it to the exhibition yourself, I highly recommend getting a hold of the catalog if you can afford it, if you can find it at a public library, and enjoying what it has to offer, because it does tell the same story in a different way. And the more processor inside of me wanted to know exactly how they were built to complement one another. So Kathleen's going to tell us all about it. How are the book and the exhibition meant to be different? I mean, did you prepare them for different audiences? Are they meant to be consumed together? What was the conception behind both in relation to one another?
So we believed strongly that the project was important, and exhibitions are ephemeral, right? They're up for a while and then they're gone. So we wanted the project to have a lasting legacy, and there hadn't been there hasn't been a book that brings together this broad a scope of inquiry about West Africa and trans-Saharan trade. So we felt that this subject deserved a really substantial publication that would add to the story we're able to tell in the exhibition. So we consider the book to be a companion publication, not an exhibition catalog. It doesn't publish every object in the exhibition, but it publishes many of the objects that you'll see in the exhibition. It also publishes things that aren't in the exhibition, but mostly it goes into much deeper depth about the different components that are in many respects sort of told in broad brushstrokes in the exhibition. So the book has 19 chapters. It has 21 contributors working across three continents, and it is unabashedly interdisciplinary. The project is involved art historians, archaeologists, historians, and specialists in comparative literature, as well as anthropologists and others. And so in the book, there are contributions from across these disciplines. And each one is written in the sort of voice of that particular discipline. It also features specialists working across regions. So you know that our areas of specialization sometimes end up being quite compartmentalized also by region. So we have specialists who work in sub-Saharan Africa, in the Saharan region, in Europe, in North Africa. And we bring all of that together in a single book. So when you, it's also intended to be written with, for, to have a great deal of interest for
specialists, but in a language that's accessible to the non-specialist. So because this is meant to be bringing a story, the story more into the mainstream, it felt important that the chapters were engaging and written, in a way that wasn't overly, using overly specialized vocabularies. So all of that is woven into the book. It's also felt important that it be beautiful. And because it is a book that's coming out of an art museum and art history. And so we actually worked with photographers in Mali, Morocco, and Nigeria to photograph, in some instances, for the first time, things that are seen in the exhibition catalog. So you can imagine that many of the archaeological fragments or recently excavated things had not been photographed for publication in a major book. So we did the work of photographing all of that material with photographers based in each country. And so that is, and all of the illustrations in the book are in color.
It truly is a beautiful text. And I also, you don't say this often about coffee table style books, but it's very easy to pick it up, read a chapter, then put it back down. It's not the sort of thing that you sort of need to labor over. You can enjoy it and you can put it back. And I think each chapter is very compartmentalized, even though it tells part of the larger story, and it definitely falls at the theme of everything. But it's absolutely stunning. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's an achievement in itself. So I want to ask you more about sort of the conception of the exhibit, because like you mentioned earlier that it took 8 years to come to this point where it's finally open to the public. If you could talk about that and also sort of how the creation of the catalog or the exhibition book came along.
Mm-hmm. So, it takes a long time. You know, we started from scratch in building the exhibition, and the germ of the idea grew out of I was deeply interested in medieval West Africa. I sat down and I started reading archaeological site reports and of sites from the medieval period from around the Sahara Desert. And I started making a list of the things that were coming out of the ground. And, you know, I have a PhD in African art history and my mind was blown. So it was just so striking to me to realize that, you know, fragments of porcelain from central China were excavated at Tadmeka on the southern fringe of the Sahara Desert in present-day Mali. You know, the scope of that material record is mind-blowing. So it took a while for me. I had to meet people. I had to reach out to these archaeologists. And the archaeologists I'm working with are one is based here in the U.S., but, you know, another is based in the U.K., and another is based in Morocco, and another is based, or two are based in Mali, and another is based in Nigeria. So, you know, all of that had to come together, and then meeting other specialists who are working on this. And then everybody coming together, and I think it wasn't until the third scholars meeting. In each meeting, I would start the meeting with a presentation, a kind of about where I was and my thinking about what might be in the exhibition and what the narrative of the exhibition might be. And it wasn't until the third meeting that I finally landed on a narrative that worked, one that moved both through space and through time. And it was after that I started conceptualizing what the book might look like. We all agreed that it was important that the book go into much deeper depth into each place or each topic than the exhibition could. And I got a lot of feedback from the scholars involved in the project about how they might do the book. But in the end, I kind of went with the way I thought I wanted to do the book to be the best reflection of the project. And so I organized the book into four different sections: groundwork, sites, matter in motion, and reverberations. And those sort of section headings speak for themselves. But, you know, as you read through the book, each chapter is in a sense like this fragment of information, and it is meant to kind of convey a whole.
When I visited the exhibition Caravans of Gold, I actually went twice in one day. So I went before I interviewed Kathleen, and that was about 9 a.m. in the morning. And then I went around 11. And when I went at 11, it was bustling. I have never seen a museum space that alive with excitement, with people moving back and forth and looking at objects and comparing them. And I'm not talking about small children. I'm talking about fully grown adults who are captivated by the objects on display and the way they were displayed. So I asked Kathleen about this. Who were they targeting when they built this exhibition? I mean, if exhibits, if museums, if academia is not neutral, what message were they trying to send and how was it received?
This is an exhibition that is taking some very specialized studies, bringing them together, and then kind of filtering them for a general public, because we feel that this is a story that needs to move into the mainstream. And so, you know, my role as the curator is to find ways to get this story out there, because it's really can completely change the way we look at our present by looking at the past through a wider lens and seeing where there were interconnections and where there were players that maybe through time have been pushed to the side.
What is, if your audience could take away one message from the exhibition, what do you think that should be?
That Africa played, or West Africa played, a really important role in the formation of the world, the world of the medieval period, and that that has influenced the world we live in today.
Is that why you use the term medieval specifically, because you want to show these interconnections?
Yeah, I mean, this was a topic of conversation, so it's important to understand that this exhibition, and obviously the book reflects that, has been put together over an 8-year period, working with a team of interdisciplinary specialists. And in that 8-year period of time, we had 4 meetings where we all came together and we talked about what the narrative of the show would be. And in one of those meetings, we talked specifically about language. And one of those conversations was about the word medieval. And in the end, we felt that by co-opting the word medieval and insisting on its globality, that we were doing something important. The other thing is that we realized that the dates, this was through audience evaluation, if you say 8th to 16th century, most North Americans don't know how to understand where that sits within time. So they can't come up with it. Most North Americans can't come up with examples of what happened in the 8th to 16th century. And it's like a really big period of time, right? So, but if you say medieval, people have a starting point. They can say, oh, okay, knights and kings and queens and the plague or whatever it is, right? Their starting point. And when you tie the word medieval to the word Africa, most people find that juxtaposition to be really intriguing and surprising. And so it creates curiosity. And so we thought, if for a show geared to a general public, that was a really important attribute to using the word medieval.
What's the reception been to the exhibit itself?
Well, so I can tell you anecdotally that it's been phenomenal, but also we've done some exhibition, while the exhibition's up, we've done some audience evaluation. And so, for instance, we know that the average time people spend in the exhibition is 45 minutes, which is huge for a museum exhibition, and that people find
the content challenging to onboard, but they're willing to do the work. And so that really, you know, supports our initial idea that this would be a story that people would be eager to hear about because it's one that they're not altogether familiar with.
One thing I applaud you for that I didn't know until I ran through the exhibit earlier today was that the text is in Arabic, and the headings for each of the different sections of the exhibit and the exhibit title itself, on one side you have English, on one side you have Arabic, and I really appreciated that, partially because to put Arabic in the public sphere in North America is really challenging. I'm sure you are in an art museum, people know, are sort of primed to anticipate that they're going to be faced with objects from different contexts, but it's still quite a bold thing to do.
Well, thank you. I mean, we felt very strongly, this is a very multivocal exhibition, and by foregrounding the title of the exhibition right at the get-go in two languages, Arabic and English, and then reiterating that through the exhibition with each section heading, we felt that that would make the point really. A lot of what happens in a museum exhibition happens somewhat subliminally, and that's one of those moments where we're making that point just through the visual encounter. So it's not that we thought a bunch of, you know, Arabic-speaking people would be coming and they would need to read that text. We were making a point through its use that this is an exhibition that from the start has to be seen through multiple lenses, and that Islam and Arabic are an important part of this story.
I think that's one thing you foreground really well by the use of texts, because you have a certain section of the exhibit where you have texts in Arabic or in Ajami, I think some of them are in Ajami. And what I like about that, the use of the Arabic in the actual signage, is that Arabic isn't otherized as simply a category or an artifact. It's part of the nature of the exhibit. It signals that your partner is abroad. But then you have the artifacts, and all of a sudden the artifacts are part of this living language because you see the Arabic text, but then you actually see the text themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But the texts themselves, I think, do a really excellent job of, and I think this is included in the book, but anyone who's familiar with Islamic studies or Middle Eastern history, North African history generally, or the history of the Muslim world, knows that Arabic is basically the Latin of the Muslim world. It's a living language. It's used in ways that Latin perhaps was not in the same period, but it is the language of intellects.
Yes, right. So Arabic, of course, is one of the things that moves across the Sahara Desert in the medieval period. And for the purposes of this exhibition and the book, we identify the medieval period as going from the 8th century, which is when Islam and Arabic begin to move across the Sahara Desert, and the 16th century, when Atlantic trade begins to dominate over trans-Saharan trade. So as Arabic and Islam move, merchants and kings and enslaved people are also moving as our goods. So this is an exhibition that's looking at the movement of things, people, and ideas. And we're looking at Arabic. One of the contributors to the catalog talks about Arabic as a technology, as well as a kind of container for knowledge. And so we look at it in both of those frames in the exhibition, and also how West Africans very early on begin to contribute to an intellectual tradition using the Arabic language. So we feature books that are circulating from, Spain or the Middle East or North Africa, but also scholars like Ahmed Baba, who was from Timbuktu, lived in the 16th century, and how he and his peers are part of a scholarly tradition.
A question that plagues me on a day-to-day basis is whether those of us who focus solely on research or research and teaching, so those of us who are professors, if we don't think enough about the ethics of our work and whether or not that impedes our work. I honestly believe that curators, conservators, librarians, and archivists think much more in line with these principles, and their work falls in line with these principles as a result. And this is where we can learn from them. So I posed several questions about best practices to Kathleen, hoping in turn that I can learn something that I can apply to my own work.
So, I want to start with humbleness. this is a project that could only be done through collaboration. And it was important to start with a recognition of how little I knew and really how little I'll ever know. So, I have the good fortune to be the spokesperson for the project and for the people who contributed to the catalog, but I'll never be the kind of expert in the areas that they focus on that they are. And that's, I felt really privileged to be part of that. In terms of the relationship building, collaboration takes a commitment of time, and it takes both going and hosting. So I've traveled to Mali, Morocco, and Nigeria multiple times in the years that I've been working on the exhibition. I've also invited people, and we, the Black Museum, has invited people here to Northwestern in that period of time multiple times, because relationships they're relationships, right? They're relational, so it requires going both ways. Listening and really being willing to let each contributor have a say and a place. One of the great things that we were able to do in terms of the programming during the exhibition is we brought 6 archaeologists here to campus. All of them contributed to the book. And I thought it would be amazing to have them actually here together to talk to our audiences. We visited schools. We had programs with students on campus. We also had public programs. And they were able to share their work directly in their own voice with a much bigger audience than they'd ever done before, but also to talk to each other. So being willing to make those opportunities for, your collaborators. We did the same the week of the opening. We had representatives from all the lender institutions here, and in some instances, multiple individuals. And we hosted a meeting where these museum and cultural patrimony institutions in Mali, Morocco, Nigeria, they all sat down together to talk to each other. And it was the first time some of them had ever met each other. So, we were making sure in any good partnership that everybody's getting something out of it, mm-hmm. I think is important. And then for this exhibition, because we're dealing with materials of cultural patrimony, making the commitment to shed light on the value and importance of preserving those materials and the good work that's being done in those home countries to preserve and tell their own stories. So to bring those stories to a public beyond those places also, I think, is kind of a best practice.
So at the top of the interview, you heard Kathleen tell us about her favorite object. Now, I didn't anticipate asking this question when I walked in and interview her. I was inspired by the exhibit itself because I fell in love with several of the objects, and I could list any number of the objects in the exhibition as my favorites. There was this large talismanic fabric. There were these prayer beads. There were the manuscripts. So here's the entire clip of Kathleen telling us about her favorite object.
This is a horrible question to ask, and I like asking it to elicit the reaction. Do you have a favorite object in the exhibit?
Do I have a favorite exhibition? You know, this exhibition is so multivocal, it's hard to have a single favorite object, but I do have a couple personal favorites. One of my favorite objects in the exhibition is a biconical bead. It's an object that I've known of for a long time. It's in the collection of the Troy Institute of Art. It dates to the late 18th or 19th century, and it was probably made in Senegal. It's quite large. It's 2 to 3 inches in diameter at its widest point. A biconical bead basically looks like two ice cream cones that are put together at the mouth. And so this is a bead that I first saw illustrated in a book in the 1990s. And I've just always loved it. And it was only through this project that I've come to understand where that bead shape comes from. It's actually a bead shape that originates in the medieval period and possibly even before. And it's really widespread across the Islamic world. And it made its way across the Sahara Desert in the medieval period. So for instance, at Gao, they have excavated small terracotta beads from a medieval context that are miniature biconical beads. So we can see that it's a really distinctive shape. That shape is traveling in the medieval period. And in this bead from the Detroit Institute, collection, you can see how that bead form has also traveled through time. And in fact, you can still buy biconical beads in markets or from goldsmiths in Bamako or in, Agadez in Niger. So this is a bead form that is rooted in the medieval past, but is hugely relevant still to this day as a kind of representation of identity, and they're just so beautiful.
That was a particularly nasty question to ask. It's asking you to pick a child.
Well, I mean, another one that we have to talk about, of course, is the Tada seated man. This is an almost life-size cast copper figure of a man seated in a very naturalistic pose, and it comes from the forest region of Nigeria. It was almost certainly made at or near the city of Ife, but it was found in the town of Tada, which sits right on the banks of the Niger River. And it's cast from pure copper with just traces of arsenic and tin in the copper, which is phenomenal. A phenomenal feat, casting pure copper. It was made in the 13th or 14th century, and it represents an elite individual, probably some kind of leader, whether a religious leader or a political leader. And for the purposes of this exhibition, what's really intriguing about it is where that copper comes from. So there's only been one isotopic test of the copper undertaken, but that test suggests that the origins for the copper might in fact be the Alps region of Europe, might come from the French Alps. And we know that copper was one of the commodities that was circulating widely in this Mediterranean and Saharan world in the medieval period. And at Ife, where they had deeply rooted and very technically astounding copper casting practices, well established. They are importing the raw materials for casting copper and copper alloy objects, and that connects them to, we can see through an object like that how connected they were to this interregional world.
I want to thank you for sticking around for a rather unconventional interview. Yes, we were talking about the catalog or the companion to this exhibition, but we spent a lot of time talking about the exhibition as well. Also, I'm traditionally the host for the Middle East Studies channel, and this is more West Africa the Sahara. And it was a little out of my wheelhouse, but it's an area that I seek to educate myself more on, and I wanted to bring that to this audience in particular. So if you're a longtime New Books listener, you know what I'm about to ask Kathleen, and it's basically, what's she up to now?
So I always sort of end the interviews with, well, I mean, first off, congratulations. It's a beautiful exhibit. It's a phenomenal book, and I think the book will ensure that the exhibition and all the hard work and the collection, the curation of the objects will live on, and the themes will live on, I hope. But I always ask, what are you working on now? What are your projects that you sort of got in the docket?
That's a really hard question to answer right now because I'm still so in the thick of Caravans of Gold. The exhibition, of course, is traveling to the Aga Khan Museum in Toronto and then to the National Museum of African Art. It will continue to travel through the end of 2020. And we're closely involved in working with our partner venues on the movement of the exhibition. In many cases, you know, we travel with it. We I'll be talking at both of those venues. And so there's also been a great deal of interest in the project from other institutions. And so I'm involved in talking to them about how it's been done. And there's been huge international interest in the project. We've actually had press in 16 different countries. So it doesn't feel like, even though it's going to be closing soon at the block, that it's by any means over. But I'm also working on what's coming next in the short, middle, and long run here at the museum. Part of my job is to make sure that we have a really balanced program and one that is global in scope. And so I'm thinking about, you know, what other exhibitions can we present here at the Black Museum that continue to tell these stories about through time and place.